Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Francine Prose, whose latest book is Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife. Francine Prose is author of several novels, the most recent of which is Golden Grove, also Reading Like a Writer, A Changed Man, Blue Angel, and 15 novels in all. Francine Prose, your previous book, Golden Grove, is from the point of view of a 13-year-old girl, her voice. It's a novel of adolescence. And then we see a book about Anne Frank, a diarist, not quite a diarist, as we'll find out in a few moments, who was also approximately the same age. Is that just coincidence, or were you already obsessed or working on Anne Frank when you began working on Golden Grove?
Well, no, and in fact, in the middle of those two books, I also did a so-called young adult novel about a 14-year-old girl. So I suppose you could see a pattern emerging. No, in fact, I reread The Diary of Anne Frank because I was working on Golden Grove. And in Reading Like a Writer, I told everyone, including myself, to look to the literary classics if you're going to try to write something. So consequently, Anne Frank really came out of having reread the book in preparation to write Golden Grove.
Before we get to Anne Frank, did it make a difference in terms of the voice of the character in Golden Grove?
Absolutely, because I was writing from the point of view of a 13-year-old girl, and needless to say, there's so much that you forget. I mean, there's so much what it means to have a different body and a different self and a different being, really. So reading Anne Frank really reminded me of all sorts of things I'd forgotten about what it's like to be that age.
Well, you'd read the book, and had you taught the book before or no?
Anne Frank? No, I hadn't. And it was only after, once I started working on the Anne Frank book, then I started teaching it, because basically I always rely on my students to help me with whatever I'm doing. So I knew that I could count on them to provide me with assistance, really. And in fact, the last chapter of my book is essentially a transcription of the class I taught at Bard College.
So you've written Golden Grove, you've read Anne Frank. How did the obsession begin?
Well, when I read Anne Frank, I mean, of course, I'd read it as a little kid, as a girl, and then I reread it about 20 years ago. I was doing an essay about it for a collection of essays about the Holocaust. And when I read it this time, I realized things about it that I couldn't possibly have realized when I read it as a girl or even 20 years ago. I mean, having written all those several books, I realized how hard it is to write and how hard it is to find the right tone for writing, and how extremely hard it is to write about oneself. So when I reread the diary, I thought, boy, this is much more difficult than I'd known or suspected, and she's much better at it than I'd known or suspected. So that led me really to further research into the diary.
Now, at that point, you were reading what you call the Sea Diary, which is Otto Frank's version of the various writings of Anne Frank.
Well, yeah, Otto Frank's edit, I would say.
Okay,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, but the thing is that, like most people, I didn't even know that I was reading the Sea version. I thought, I think, as most people do, that I was reading the only version. I mean, I knew, for example, that there had been this so-called definitive version that was published in 1995 that had 30% more material than the 1952 version. The Sea version, so-called, is the one that was published in this country in 1952, The Diary of a Young Girl. But it was only when I started doing research that I realized that there was an A, B, and C version, and that the A version, which was Anne's first draft, was written in the little cloth check book that we all think of as the diary. And then she continued with that draft in two black exercise books. And then during the last few months, the last 4, 5, 6 months in the attic, she went back and revised the diary from scratch on loose sheets of colored paper, something like 320-something loose sheets of paper. And that's the so-called B version, the revisions. And then after the war, when her father was editing the book for publication, he combined the original and the revisions.
There's something else again in there, and maybe I got it wrong, but apparently he also took material from short stories.
Well, she wrote a sort of occasional pieces, kind of essays about life in the secret annex, and those are collected in a book that's called Tales from the Secret Annex. And some of the sections that are in the diary or the C version of the diary, for example, there's a famous section about peeling potatoes, about the two families and get together to peel potatoes, was a separate piece that Anne wrote. And so he just combined that. He dated it, really, as if it were a diary entry and added it to the diary.
You've read the diary and you begin to do research. At what point did you decide, well, there's nobody really who's examined the entire Anne Frank story from beginning to end. Maybe I'll do it.
You know, for one thing, I couldn't believe it, because when I started reading the three versions, which have been published for years now, I mean, they were published in 1989 in English, so it's not as if I unearthed some hidden manuscript from some archive somewhere. It's been out there. It's readily available. You can get it in bookstores online. But when I realized the differences between the versions, I was really kind of astonished, and I kept, you know, showing friends and calling people up and saying, listen, I'm going to read you two versions of the same thing. What do you think? And my friends would say, well, they're obviously revisions of the same section of the same incident. And I would say, well, that's what I thought, but how come no one said this before? In fact, it's not quite true that no one has said it. I mean, several Anne Frank scholars have said it. Judith Thurman wrote a wonderful essay for The New Yorker and said it. But what no one has done is really sit down, no one that is before me, has really sit down and compared it line by line, because the process is maddening because of the way it's printed. I mean, in the critical edition, the A, B, and C version are printed in parallel bands across the page. So you're reading these little narrow bands and turning the pages and trying not to be distracted by everything else that's on the page. You know, in fact, in that same essay, Judith Thurman says, oh, it's like reading directions for how to put together a hang glider. I mean, it's really very challenging and difficult and kind of maddening. It took me months of working on it to, first of all, to understand what I was reading, and second of all, to sit down and say, okay, this is what she did, and this is the enormity of the changes she made.
In other words, nobody had really sat down and said, well, you know, there's an earlier version that is not written quite as well, that is written by clearly a 13-year-old, and then there's a later version that goes over the same material that's deeper, better written, and would appear to be written by someone slightly older. No one had actually said
that.
Well,
it was said. It was said. I mean, for example, there's an Anne Frank scholar who knew the Frank family in Oregon named Lorene Nussbaum, and she's pointed out something that's still true, which is that Anne's own revisions, again, the so-called B version, has never been published as a standalone volume. So that still needs to be done. And there's been some pressure on the Frank Foundation to publish it as a volume, but it hasn't been done. So it's not as if people haven't noticed. But no one has sat there and gone through the incredibly tedious process of comparing it word for word, line by line, and again, extracting the passages that are the most different and the most revealing of her revision process.
Well, there's one other aspect, too, which is that second version, she intended on having it published, mm-hmm. apparently, as a novel.
Yeah, she had some idea. You know, she was a great reader. I mean, she read a huge range in, you know, the classics and German classics and the Bible and mythology, history, biology. But she was also a big fan of kind of girls' adventure novels. I mean, I think they're maybe like the Dutch equivalent of Nancy Drew books or something. And so when she first decided that she wanted the book to be published, she wrote, oh, wouldn't it be great to have a sort of romance of the secret annex? So I think that was partly in her mind. And when she started addressing the diary entries to Kitty, which was, again, very late in the process, 2 years in, the name Kitty, it's thought, is the name of one of the characters in these novels that she read. So, yeah, that's what she had in mind.
So how can we be sure that the second version, I guess we have to take Otto Frank's word, that the second version is a deepening of the first rather than a fictionalization of the first?
Well, the events aren't changed particularly. I mean, Okay. Nothing happens in the second version that doesn't happen in the first version. It's just better written. And in fact, things happen in the first version that don't happen in the second version because she took things out. You know, for example, she had kind of grown tired of Peter upstairs by the time she was revising. So she took him out of the second version, and Otto restored those sections because he thought that the romance would be a good thing for the book.
Anne Frank's life, her short life, culminates in staying in an attic for 2 years, is it?
25 months, yeah.
25 months, within sight, in a way, of rescue, but it was still a good year, 9 months, before they would have been mm-hmm. rescued, and they were betrayed, right?
They were betrayed. I mean, there's been quite a bit of controversy over who did it exactly. a lot of suspicion has fallen on one of the men who worked in the warehouse, a guy named Von Marum, because he was curious, inappropriately curious, asking a lot of nosy questions. He was found to be leaving little traps because the families came down at night from the attic into the warehouse, so he would leave little things that they could overturn or move that would give him the sense that someone was living upstairs. But then there also have been other suspects. I mean, neighbors next door. There were several break-ins, of course, so maybe people have thought the thieves did it. There's been some talk that Otto was blackmailed since the start of the occupation for making anti-Nazi remarks. So it's never been clear, really clear, who did it. And Otto Frank soon lost interest, really, in finding out who had betrayed the family. That wasn't his principal focus.
I think it's extraordinary that we're talking about this and we're not saying who Anne Frank was and what happened to her and when it happened. It's as if it's assumed that people know who Anne Frank was because they've either seen the play, the movie, or most likely read the diary of a young girl in school. That's pretty extraordinary.
Well, isn't that extraordinary? I know, and that was, again, one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because I thought, you know, isn't this amazing? Here's a girl who wrote a diary, and she's such an iconic figure that you don't have to say Anne Frank, the Dutch Jewish girl who wrote a diary in the attic and died in Bergen-Belsen. We know who she was. We know what she looked like. Her image is also iconic. I mean, she's so familiar to us.
Well, for me, I'd never read the diary, and there's a reason for it. And the reason is that I saw the film. And once I saw the film, I thought, interesting story. This girl doesn't interest me at all.
I'm sorry to hear that.
But, I mean, you can understand
that.
Yeah,
sure. I know. Well, she's not a very interesting girl in the film. And she's not a particularly interesting girl in the play either. She's just kind of a little junior Miss Teen ingenue, perky, bright little spirit. You would be very hard-pressed to figure out from the play or the film that she was a literary genius. I mean, that's not exactly emphasized for all sorts of reasons.
You say she was a literary genius. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that?
I do believe that, yeah. And again, that's why I wrote the book, to try and establish her reputation as a writer, in addition to being a victim of the Holocaust or the creator of an accidental Holocaust document. It wasn't accidental. She wrote it, and she meant to write it, and she rewrote it.
When you were working on the first section of the book, which is the story of Anne Frank, were there times where you had to kind of break free because you felt as trapped in the attic as she was, or did you never really feel you were there because you're writing about a literary work rather than about being there?
The attic was bad enough, but I have to say that, you know, the life they led in the attic, in many ways terrifying, and there were these break-ins, and towards the end, the deprivations and the difficulties were much more intense. I mean, the people who had been supplying them with food and fake ration cards and so forth and meat were arrested one by one, so even their diet deteriorated. But nonetheless, their life in the attic was a kind of simulacrum of normal life. I mean, they still had the family, they were still together, they were reading books, the girls were getting an education, and they were remarkably civilized with one another, considering the circumstances under which they were living. What was much more painful was to think about the life that she led, the short life that she led after the diary, because the situation in Westerbork, the transit camp that she went to first, and then Auschwitz, and then Bergen-Belsen, where she died, was awful, was terrible. And that was the thing that I kept finding very hard to think about and that I was trying to keep from thinking about for as long as I could, so I could go on writing the book.
And in fact, she did not die in the ovens. She died of typhus.
She died of disease. Typhus, malnutrition, illness, weakness, horrible skin diseases. She and her sister died within a few days of each other. It was in every way a terrible story.
When you were finished writing that and you moved on, I mean, it must have been a very different feeling, because suddenly the emphasis switches from the story of Anne to the story of her father and the story of a man who I'd heard of as a writer. I didn't know his entire history, by the name of Meyer Levin.
Poor Meyer Levin. Meyer Levin was an American writer who had written a couple of novels, not done very well commercially. He wanted to be part of the war. He was too old for the draft. He enlisted in the press corps. He was present at the liberation of Bergen-Belsen. He stood over the mass grave and said to himself, from this pit a voice will rise. And then when he read the diary of Anne Frank, his wife gave him a copy of the diary in French. They were living in France, a gift that she would regret. He said, oh, this is the voice I was waiting to hear, and he became obsessed. I mean, his own book about the situation called The Obsession. And he wrote to Otto Frank. He said, let me help you get the book an American publisher. Then after the book did get an American publisher, in fact, not through Meyer Levin, through other channels, he kept on and was active in the negotiations for the book. He decided that he was the perfect person to adapt it for the stage. He was serving as the agent for the book, and at the same time, he got the assignment to write the book review, the, as it turned out, front page book review for the New York Times Book Review. And he wrote this rave on the front page. The book was an instant bestseller, thanks to Meyer Levin, actually. And then as the book became more and more successful, the publishers and producers who seemed came on board realized that they had a kind of hot commercial property on their hand, and poor Meyer Levin got edged further and further out of the negotiations, and he became more and more obsessed. And it's just a horrible story. I mean, there were lawsuits and betrayals, and he wrote these insane letters to Otto Frank and so forth and so on.
Let's for a second assume that Meyer Levin didn't exist. What do you think would have happened?
Well, you know, plenty of books come out, plenty of worthy books, and just find their way rather quickly to the remainder piles. And as you know, as I say in the book, this could have happened to the diary. It could have shown up 20, 30 years later, reissued by the Holocaust Studies program of some university press. But it didn't happen that way.
The reason I ask is because if this is a great book, mm-hmm. and you're saying it's a great book, I mean, it isn't always the case. Frequently, cream does rise.
Frequently, but not always. The marvelous New York Review of Books series, they've published, I think, now 200 books or something, many of the masterpieces that have gone out of print. So that happens as well.
The other thing that saved it was this play.
Mm-hmm.
And the story of the play is, again, the story of Levin.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the story of how a work gets popularized and valorized.
Yeah, you know, in fact, I mean, Otto Frank is often accused of having distorted the diary and diminished Anne's Jewish identity and made it more palatable for popular consumption. But in fact, if you look at the diary itself, all those elements are present in the diary. Otto did not take them out of the diary, but they certainly got taken out of the play because the plan was to make it more universal, which meant less Jewish, which in turn meant more commercial. The other idea was to make it less, I don't know what, sad or tragic or depressing. So when they finally edged Meyer Levin out and they were talking in the process, they'd been talking to all the great names in American theater, Lillian Hellman, Arthur Miller, Carson McCullers, none of whom for various reasons wanted to do it. And Lillian Hellman, who became very active in the whole process and who was accused by Meyer Levin of having masterminded a Stalinist plot to de-Judify the Diary of Anne Frank. Well, you know, if you look at it, it is so not a Stalinist plot. It's actually capitalism working perfectly well because they realized that it was commercial. So with Lillian Hellman's suggestion, approval, guidance, they hired a screenwriting couple, Goodrich and Hackett, who had written Father of the Bride, It's a Wonderful Life, the Thin Man novels, adapted them, I think Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, all these kind of light, airy comedies. Because they'd done Father of the Bride, it was clear that they could work with adolescent material. Because they'd done It's a Wonderful Life, you know, with Jimmy Stewart about to kill himself, they decided that they could lighten, quote-unquote, dark material. So they were brought in to do the adaptation. It was a nightmare for them. They went through 8 drafts. It was too much like Anne Frank. It was not enough like Anne Frank. It was too serious. It was too light. It wasn't human. It wasn't, I think it was very rough on their marriage. There were these huge public fights, bursts into tears, blah, blah, blah. And finally, you know, they were rewriting until the end, really. And finally, they got it on Broadway. And I suppose you could say it worked. I mean, that is at least critically and commercially it worked.
And what happened, I think, more recently, there's a new production of the play with some changes.
Wendy Kesselman did an adaptation of the play that came out in the 90s that played on Broadway. I guess Natalie Portman played Anne Frank. It didn't have enough changes. I mean, it had some changes, and there was an attempt because I spoke to Wendy Kesselman, and she said that after she'd read the diary with the additional material restored and after she'd, you know, had a sense, of course, of what had happened to Anne, of her actual fate, of her biography, there was an attempt to add all that. But the problem was, or one of the problems was, that under the terms of the copyright of the original play, no more than 10% of the material could be altered of the original play. So she, in some ways, had her hands tied when she was readapting it, because there were only a limited number of changes that they could make.
Well, is there any way that somebody could take a look at the diary and completely rewrite from scratch, or is that...
Well, you know, there was just this plan for David Mamet to do a new production of it for Disney, and I know, I thought the same thing. I thought, has Disney never heard of David Mamet? Has David Mamet never heard of Disney? I mean, it was so unlikely. And it was going forward for a while. I kept hearing about it. And then apparently what happened was David Mamet took the entire story out of the attic in Amsterdam and moved it to Israel and had Anne Frank be a young girl who was affected. Her life was ruined in some way by suicide bombings, which was not what Disney had in mind at all, which was neither was it what Anne Frank had in mind at all. So the project went into, as they say, turnaround, and I don't know what's, you know, I don't think anyone knows if someone else is going to pick up David Mamet's screenplay or if Disney is going to find another writer. I don't know. And also, I mean, it was predictable because David Mamet has become a fairly serious Zionist. So right. When I heard that this was going on, I mean, the joke in our household was this time it's going to be the Palestinians instead of the Gestapo who knock on the door. Well, sure enough, the joke was uncomfortably close to the truth.
Then there was the movie, and as I said before, the movie turned me off. The relationship of the movie to the play, if the play defanged the book, then the film defanged the play.
Again, it was a very complicated story. I mean, George Stevens, who was chosen to be the director, was a documentarian during World War II. When you go to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington and you get off the elevator, the first thing you see is the video footage that George Stevens shot of the liberation of Dachau. So George Stevens knew the story. And also George Stevens had a couple of not so successful films. He was still seen as a relatively commercial director, so that this would bring people to the theaters, it would revive his career. He had an idea to sort of do a sort of European auteur thing, you know, to film it in black and white. Hollywood had just invented, or, you know, fostered the invention of, I can't remember if it was CinemaScope or not, but it was some very wide angle thing, which was very problematic for this particular film since it took place within the confined space of an attic. So George Stevens had the set built vertically so that the camera could go up and down. Nonetheless, Hollywood is Hollywood. So all the Hollywoodization of the story, casting, for example, Millie Perkins to play Anne Frank, who was a fashion model, essentially. And, I mean, one of the things that I discovered that I found fascinating and sort of eerie was that Otto Frank very much wanted Audrey Hepburn to play Anne Frank in the film. And he himself went to see Audrey Hepburn in Switzerland, her villa, to try and talk her into it because she was Dutch, because she'd lived through the war in Holland. She was half Dutch. And Audrey Hepburn wisely said, I'm 28 years old. I can't possibly play a 13-year-old. So they found Millie Perkins, and it always seemed to me that the direction that Stevens seems to have given Millie Perkins was to play Anne Frank as if she were Audrey Hepburn playing Anne Frank. So that's the impression you get. And, you know, she has this kind of actressy diction and this super cute, perky delivery. So it's nothing like the person who wrote that diary.
But it's also true that even if she's playing younger, she's playing 16 or 17. She's not playing 12 or 13.
Right, I know. And she was, I think, 18. George Stevens had some idea that this difficulty could be worked out. It couldn't be worked out. But also what was done to the script. I mean, she says near the end, you know, it ends with that, I still believe that people are really good at heart, and the music comes up and the camera pans the sky and there are all these fluffy clouds and birds twittering. But there's this remarkable line where she says something like, and now, dear diary, our stay here is over. And you go, our stay here is over? What? I guess it was the Anne Frank archive. I can't remember where I saw it. Or maybe it's, I can't remember, but you can see the trailer for the film. There lies in hiding, da-da-da-da. And then the thrill of her first kiss. And in the film, when you hear the kind of hee-haw of the Gestapo sirens downstairs, she and Richard Bamer, who play Peter, kind of glom together in her first kiss. And so her first kiss happens at the moment when they're being arrested by the Gestapo. I mean, really, what could be more tasteless?
Somehow, though, after that, even though the film and the play disappeared, the life of the book went on. At what point did it become something that was taught regularly in the schools, do you think?
Well, that started in the late 50s, and it really, you know, again, it's so complicated to talk about anything about this book, because whatever we say about the play and the film and how they distorted the diary or not, the fact was that they helped popularize the diary tremendously, not only here but in Europe. And ultimately, in many cases, the play and the film sent people back to the diary. So it had a great deal to do with the popularity of the screen and stage version that the diary became so widely read and taught in the schools.
But it's taught primarily as a historical document, whereas I guess you're saying that along with being taught as a historical document, it should be taught as a literary work.
I think it should be taught, you know, both ways. I mean, a historical document, a Holocaust document, and as a work of literature. And I think that it would be really useful for students to be told, look, it doesn't happen all the time. Maybe it will never happen again. Who knows if it ever happened before? But there was actually a masterpiece actually written by a teenage girl. It's possible it did happen.
When you're reading what your students write now and comparing it to the sophistication of a diary written by a 13, 14, 15-year-old who went to school in Europe in the late 30s, early 40s, what does it say about our schooling system here in America? Does it tell us anything, or do you think that some of them were Anne Frank's too at 13?
Well, who knows? You know, and also, at 13, she was writing like a 13-year-old. I mean, kind of the point is what happened to her in those 2 years. So, God willing, there will be no teenagers walled up in an attic for 25 months, being able to do nothing except read and write and become writers in that way. Nonetheless, I mean, I don't teach very often. I mean, I do go into schools and talk to kids in high schools and junior high schools, but I teach college students. So, you know, the difference between, if you look at the difference in Anne Frank between 13 and 15, the difference between 15 and 20, say, which is the age of many of my students, is huge, huge. So, you know, it's hard to even compare. Nonetheless, my students are extraordinary. Extraordinary. In fact, the last chapter of the book is made up mostly of quotes from my students at Bard College from a class that I taught. And the little papers they wrote and the things they said in class were so beautiful and so beautifully put that I just included them in the book.
Francine Prose, since you're teaching college and you're teaching writing, you know, mostly what we hear about are negatives about our educational system.
Mm-hmm.
But from what you're saying, either you're getting the cream of the crop or maybe we're underestimating our current educational system.
I think we're underestimating kids, period. And I think that so many of the things that are wrong with the educational system come from underestimating kids. You know, to say nothing of the moronic, idiotic, brutal programs like No Child Left Behind, and which have no interest in education at all. You know, to say nothing of how desperately underpaid teachers are, to say nothing of how overcrowded classrooms are. I mean, quite honestly, don't get me started. Quite honestly, it's a miracle that any kid emerges from our own educational system with anything, given how hard it is to get an education under those circumstances. But the fact is, kids are resilient, kids are smart. There are kids who are determined to learn something, and they still do.
Do you think that the internet, computer, my initial thought was that these were negatives, but the internet and the computer has gotten everyone I know, every kid I know, writing. I mean, what they're writing may not look quite like what I thought English should be, but everyone knows how to type by the age of 10, and they're all writing.
Yeah, and they're also audiences for each other. I guess that has good things and bad things. I mean, you know, it's affected us in every way. Needless to say, I mean, so many other people have said this, but it's affected our notions of privacy. I mean, Anne Frank was originally writing for herself, and then subsequently writing for the public. If you're blogging, there is no writing for yourself. You're always writing for the public, so that's very different from the beginning.
And you start wondering if, you know, the blog of Anne Frank, but then again, maybe if there were blogs, the word would have gotten out about the Holocaust, and the Germans might not have been able to get away with it. I don't know.
The word was out. The word was out. I mean, Roosevelt knew about it. Churchill knew about it. Everybody who had the power to do something about it knew about it. So it wasn't as if it were some secret that was happening in Germany. So, you know, there's a wonderful book, and I'm afraid I can't remember the writer now, called Why We Watched. And it's about just that, about how many people knew what was going on and how they could have stopped it.
The people who knew and didn't, and this is not to excuse mm-hmm. them at all, but they also had no pressure. And if the word was out on the street, which it wasn't, then, in fact, pressure could have changed things. I'm just speculating, obviously.
Yeah, well, you know, I never know what to think about it. I mean, for example, when I was growing up, we managed to exert a considerable amount of pressure and helped get us out of Vietnam. I don't know, you know, helped, you know, using that word broadly, helped get us out of Vietnam. I wonder how much pressure. I mean, I was in the demonstration before we invaded Iraq, huge demonstration in New York City, and that was reported as having a couple of thousand people. We tried to exert some pressure. People continued trying to exert some pressure, and the avenues for exerting that pressure seem to have gotten narrower and narrower. I mean, we're still doing it. I mean, there's been pressure to close Guantanamo, to stop the black sites and the torture, and as much as we hear that it's ending, it's still going on. So, you know, the times in history when pressure does something and doesn't do anything, that's a very complicated question, I think.
Last month, for another interview, I read a book called Human Smoke by Nicholson Baker, mm-hmm. and that's when you learn that these people really could have saved millions of lives
sure.
and didn't.
Oh, sure.
And Anne Frank's life could very
of
easily
course.
Have been one of them.
Of course, of course, of
and,
course.
And in fact, her father tried to get them to America.
Well, yeah, I mean, Otto Frank has been accused of being passive and not being realistic, but just a few years ago, there's a whole cache of letters unearthed in which he begs with people he knew in the United States. He tries to get a visa to go to Cuba for his family. The letters are heartbreaking, but by then, no one was listening.
Having written this book, taking this different approach to writing, can you see yourself ever writing a similar book? The Diary of Anne Frank, Diary uh-huh, of a Young Girl, is not the only book that
right,
stands outside
right,
of history.
Right, right. I have a contract and have been thinking and making notes for a book about Huckleberry Finn. So that's another possibility. Not even a possibility, a probability, or it's going to happen. And, you know, I never know. I mean, the next nonfiction book I think I'm writing is about photography. I want to take several iconic photographs and talk about modern history through photography.
How about your next novel?
I've started working on it, and I'm too superstitious to say anything.
Well, you also write essays.
Mm-hmm. I'm writing now about the Robert Frank show, the photography show that's now in New York. I think it was in San Francisco already and Washington, D.C. I'm writing a number of book reviews and essays. Oh, I'm writing an essay for Lewis Lapham's Quarterly about religion and misogyny. So that's sort of fun. I've been doing a certain amount of research. You know, why the world's religions hate women so much and how much that has deformed all of our lives.
I remember reading way back when during the, I guess, revisionism about the history of religion, that religions at one point were all maternal-centric, and then somewhere along the line they became patriarchal.
Early along the line. You know, the fact that Judaism and Christianity and Islam come directly out of patriarchal tribal culture, which is quite old, so you'd have to go back pretty far beyond that.
But if you go back that far, do you find that, or was that just
there were goddess religions, certainly, but again, too far back to help us particularly.
Francine Prose, I think we discussed this last time you were here. You can teach parts of writing, but there are parts of writing you can't teach.
Right. Yeah, you can't teach talent, unfortunately. Talent, I mean, as Anne Frank proves, develops slowly and differently for different people at different stages. So who knows when talent will manifest itself. You can teach editing. You can teach line editing. You can teach revision. You know, in fact, you could teach revision on the basis of looking at Anne Frank's two versions of the same event.
How important is it teaching grammar, spelling? This is something that came up not that long ago in an article in the New York Times, I think it was Stanley Fish wrote a long diatribe about how university professors are ignoring all of that in favor of just content.
Well, it's extremely important because, as I keep telling students, the most important thing about writing, I mean, more important than lyricism or poetry or originality or, you know, anything, is clarity. And grammar exists for no other reason than to make it clear what you're saying. And you're right, though, it's going out of whatever currency. I had this very disturbing discussion with an editor from a national newspaper who was editing a review I'd written, and she changed something, and I said, well, you know, I have no objection to your changing things and editing things, but the way you changed it was ungrammatical. I said, the phrase before the comma modifies the noun after the comma. That's just how it is. And she said, well, it's not a rule. And I said, well, actually, it's a rule. So, you know, if that's what we're getting from editors at national newspapers, we're in a certain amount of trouble.
Francine Prose, are you done with Anne Frank now?
I think so, although you never know. I mean, you know, needless to say, I always say once you write something, then you find out what you should have written. I mean, last night I gave a talk and a woman came up to me with a newspaper clip about Anne Frank's still surviving cousin kind of working, entertaining at parties as a clown, I think. I mean, which I wish I'd seen, not that it necessarily would have gone into the book. But, you know, and in fact, now that the book's come out, I've met quite a number of people who have parents who knew Anne Frank, so I wished I'd met them earlier.
And Anne Frank would have been 80 years old this past June.
In June, yeah.
You've been listening to an interview with Francine Prose, whose latest book is Anne Frank, The Book, The Life, The Afterlife, and her most recent novel, Golden Grove, which came out in 2008.
And is in paperback now.
I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.